Welcome to this Webster Support Technical Exchange Ask the Expert session. Today's topic is exploring various components of Data Power Gateway Appliance with the experts. My name is Kathy Kuhn, and this session will give you the opportunity to speak to our panel of experts on a variety of subjects related to today's topic. Moving on to slide two. In today's session, we will start by introducing our panel of experts to you. We will then move on to give you a brief introduction to exploring various components of Data Power Gateway Appliances. Next, our panel of experts will answer questions they submitted. Then, we will open the lines for a Q&A period. Finally, the session will conclude with a summary of today's session. On to slide three. At this time, I would like to pass control over to Trey Williamson to begin the introduction of our panel of experts. Trey?
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Trey Williamson. I work in Data Power Support. I've been doing this for several years, and I'll be presenting the network topic. Jin?
Yeah, hi. My name is Jin Sahu. I am the team lead for Data Power Support, Data Power and API Management Support. I have been working with Data Power Support for the last 7 or 8 years. I'll be talking with guys on the Data Power integration with NQ and the association of the SSL connection when we upgrade the firmware from lower version to the V6 and V7. Dominic?
Hi, everyone. I am Dominic Cali. I'm part of the Data Power Support team as well and the Pod Crash League. I will be going over the virtual memory question.
Hi, this is Brent Garnett, the WS Pod Lead. I'll be going over SQL tracing and how to effectively map this to logs. Clarissa.
Hi, my name is Clarissa Washington. I am the Security Pod Lead. And I'll be going over the IBM LDAP authentication.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Paul Magani. I work in the Accelerated Value Program. I'm an Accelerated Value Leader and Accelerated Value Specialist for Data Power. And today I will be covering some style sheet profiling and style sheet tracing. Kathy, back to you.
Thank you, Paul. At this time, we would start with the introduction, so we are going to go on to slide four and pass it back to Paul.
Thank you, Kathy. Thank you. So, folks, we're going to discuss topics that are applicable to the Data Power firmware 6.0, 6.01, 6.02, 7, 7.1, 7.2. We'll cover a number of questions, networking, user working with multiple interfaces. Clarissa is going to touch on RBM and LDAP. My colleague Brent is going to talk about SQL, OEBC tracing. I'll talk about style sheet profiling and style sheet tracing. My colleague Chin will talk about MQ. And then lastly, my colleague Dominic McCallie will talk about the virtual appliance and as it relates to memory. So as a basic introduction, and without further ado, let me turn it over to Trey, who's going to talk about multiple network interfaces.
Thanks, Paul. So, slide five. Thanks. Multiple network interfaces sounds like a very benign, simple issue. How can you configure Data Power to use multiple network interfaces for redundancy and prevent routing issues? This may sound like a very simple, like I said, even benign task, but it's one topic that has kept me gainfully employed in support for many years. It's something that has paged out many weekends. It's caused many production issues, so it sounds simple, but it is the ground that all the communication flows over. So if you would please proceed to slide six. Many folks configure multiple network interfaces. This is done to achieve some type of redundancy, to increase throughput, to connect multiple networks, separate traffic types, etc. There are so many reasons, so many thoughts, plans, best intentions behind having multiple network interfaces configured. And rarely do those good intentions lead to the outcome or the results or the predictability that's wanted. And I will talk a little bit more about this. Suffice it to say that configuring multiple interfaces, it needs to have not just the administration of the appliance in mind, the types of traffic you're going to be handling, but also your network, the requirements of your network, security standards, network environment handling. If you have firewalls on each network, so many considerations, and it spans more than just being the administrator or the developer on the clients. Many times we need to bring in those network administrators that know the network, that know the needs, the requirements, the security guidelines, and can help guide and give proper configuration. Using multiple network interfaces does not necessarily guarantee any of these features will work in the way that you intend or hope. As I said, I've been patient many, many weekends over the years for this issue. Many times having multiple network interfaces spanning multiple subnets causes unpredictable, indeterminate routing. It causes intermittent connectivity. Believe it or not, I think one of my best examples is I've seen appliances with 300 or 400 days of uptime have absolutely no problems. And then one day all connections absolutely fail, just due to that non-deterministic routing when multiple network interfaces are being used. Multiple network interfaces more often than not simply guarantee more complicated routing tables. What starts out as a simple, I need to join 3 or 4 subnets, and now we need to get certain traffic routed absolutely, so we need to start using static routes. Many times I've seen that grow into multiple pages worth of static routes defined. And every one of those static routes has to be managed, has to be duplicated amongst multiple devices. It has to be kept in mind whenever changes to the environment are made. The routing table is the result of the configuration. And one of the biggest issues that I run into that's often overlooked is configuring two interfaces on a unique subnet may in fact actually bridge networks or allow bypassing of firewalls. You may allow a client to come in on one network and go out, come in, send a request through the appliance, go out on another network without actually having traversed the firewall that separated those segments. And many times that's a huge security risk or a huge security issue that's not considered, and not until we see the traffic flow and network administrators start questioning it, and we get called out. A lot of this can really be avoided if any type of redundancy or increased throughput is needed, some fault tolerance, some high availability. Believe it or not, there are times when I've actually had folks say, hey, listen, we're worried. What if someone accidentally pulls the wrong cable out? We have no backup, so we've got 4 network interfaces all configured on the same subnet, each one with a unique IP. And a new feature was recently developed, a new method for bridging, binding, combining interfaces. It's called link aggregation. And I cannot preach about it enough other than to say that I'm really going to stress that feature be considered whenever you're looking at having multiple network interfaces defined. It gives you your redundancy. It gives you your fault tolerance. It gives you all the features that I referred to on slide 6. And it keeps it, in a way, it keeps it simple because you're taking multiple interfaces, combining them into a single link, single route, no more multiple networks, multiple routes per network interface, leading to confusing routing tables. Any questions or concerns, thoughts, please feel free to post them in the chat. We'll bring them up at the end of the presentation. Thank you, and I'll be turning over to Clarissa for RBM.
Okay, could you advance to slide 8, I believe? Okay. So what are the best practices for RBM LDAP authentication? So RBM stands for role-based management, which controls whether an authenticated user has the necessary permissions to access certain resources on the data power appliance. There are several IBM authentication methods available, but for today, I'm going to list some of the key steps to remember when defining RBM with LDAP authentication. With the proper configuration, the Data Power LDAP client will attempt to authenticate the user with the LDAP server. And if the user is successfully authenticated, the user's DN is passed to the MAC credential step to determine the user's access permissions. Slide 9, please. To begin the IBM LDAP configuration, the user names and groups should be predefined in the LDAP server. So that's pretty straightforward. And you will need to obtain the LDAP search information, such as the bind DNs, the base DNs, and group DNs from the LDAP administrator. The bind DNs can be any valid user and password. The base DN is the base name where user entries are found. And the group DN would be any groups that the users belong to. You'll want to verify the syntax when configuring the LDAP search information on Data Power because it is case sensitive and white space sensitive. For example, if the LDAP server has the base DN set as DC equals my company with my capitalized and the white space before DC equals com, then the base DN on Data Power should be configured exactly the same. If you happen to configure the letter casing or white spacing differently, it will cause an authentication failure. And you also need to ensure proper syntax with the MAC credential XML file. For example, if LDAP returns the user's DN with everything in lowercase and several white spaces, then the user's DN and the MAC credential XML file should be exactly the same as what was returned from LDAP. Also, one other point that I missed on this slide is you want to make sure the MAC credential XML file is written using PCRE regular expression in order for all literal characters to be interpreted correctly when matching the user's DN. If there are any special characters like asterisk or backslash, those may not translate correctly and cause the credential mapping to fail. Slide 10, please. It is also a good practice to configure the local fallback users. You'll want to do this so that a user can still log into the appliance if the LDAP authentication fails for any reason or if there's some network outage that prevents communication to the LDAP server. The local users must be members of local user groups on the appliance, and each local user must also be defined in the LDAP server, and the password for each local user must match on both Data Power and LDAP. Sometimes you may feel that everything is configured correctly on Data Power, but the RBM LDAP authentication fails. So as a good troubleshooting tool, you can try using the LDAP browser that can help verify if the bind works and verify the user query results. Many LDAP browsers can be found as freeware on the web. Before version 7.0, Data Power only supported users belonging to one user group. If the user belongs to multiple groups, you must create a custom style sheet that would return only one group, and that group could be mapped against the or matched against the map credential XML file. There is a tech note that gives more detail on how to configure this. Then in version 7.0 and above, Data Power now supports users belonging to multiple user groups without a custom style sheet. You would simply configure everything as if you're searching for a user belonging to a single group. So that sums up practices for configuring RBM LDAP authentication. Slide number 11, and I'll pass it over to Paul.
Thanks, Clarissa. Okay, folks, so now we're on to style sheet profiling. My colleague Herman Stamm had done a presentation on this a number of years ago, but I just thought it was really important just to be reiterated again. So what is the benefit of style sheet profiling, and how is it configured? Can we move to slide 12? Right, so it does optimize style sheet compilation and execution and better performance for the services and transaction flow. Slide number 13. Okay, so again, we all know how important performance is on any platform, and Data Power is no exception. So, you know, you want to optimize your services such that there will not be such high latency. If you have, say, a service, a multi-protocol gateway, and has on its processing rule a number of style sheets that are quite involved, you would want those style sheets tuned so they run at their optimal best. It can be a case where we get stuck in a rule because the style sheet is taking a long time in processing. In this case, if you have a high transaction rate, all these requests will be waiting on what is processing to complete. This can cause, you know, unwanted results. Maybe the appliance would reload, and that's not something we would, again, want. In style sheet profiling, basically, all you need to do is go into a service, say an XML firewall, and configure a compile option policy for the XML manager and a matching profile rule. You would send requests against the service, and that will give you the profiling information. Flushing the XML manager style sheet cache resets the profiling information. You can also use a Data Power extension element called DP Profile, where you can insert this element into certain sections of your style sheet. You know, perhaps there are like certain portions in a very large style sheet that you would like to see the latency for that region. The screenshot on the right, now guys, I know that's kind of hard to read, but let me just go through the columns. So basically the table just summarizes the profiling information about style sheet. The table reports each template, global variable, and DP profile element that the style sheet processes. So the first column is the XML manager, the name of the XML manager employed, the output mode, whether that be general, which is a general purpose, compilation mode, no specialization, stream, specialized compilation mode, context, specialized compilation mode for output to a temporary context variable, events, which is a specialized compilation mode for event-driven output. Then you have the URL, which is the URL of the style sheet. The value might refer to a remote location or to a location on the device. We have the name, would be the name of the template, global variable, or DP profile node in the style sheet that the entry represents. The location is basically the line number in the style sheet where the template was called, or the location of the declaration of a global variable or DP profile element. For example, a report of local --/- mind.xsl:16 indicates that a template was called on line 16 of the indicated style sheet. Then we have the column called count, which is the number of times the listed entry ran during the processing of a request by the style sheet. And a template or a DP profile node can be called more than once during the processing of this style sheet. Then we have the type column, which is the type of this entry. The value can be either a template, global variable, or a DP profile node. And then time, which is basically the total time measured in milliseconds, been processing the instructions represented in this entry. Can we move to slide 14, please? Yeah, now the following slides, folks, just show the display of a service and clicking on the XML manager and setting a compile option policy and then defining a matching profile rule. So you'll see here in the green box I have the XML manager. You would click on the ellipse. Slide number 15, please. Yeah, and then you would go to the compile options policy. And if you can please move to slide number 16. And then in the green box you see the profile rule where you would set up the you know, the applicable profile rule. And if you can please advance to slide number 17. Now, this is an interesting slide. We had a case where a customer was experiencing slow performance, and we narrowed it down to a hex-to-text conversion they were doing with pure XSLT. On the left screenshot, you will see this elongated oval and the time in milliseconds. It's 57 seconds. And then by using a built-in data power extension for hex-to-text conversion, we were able to eliminate the time. So you will see that it does not show on the screenshot on the right. Now, this is a significant savings, and it's a prime example of what style sheet profiling can do for you. Slide number 18, please. And I just wanted to quickly touch on style sheet tracing. Style sheet tracing can be very useful for debugging efforts. The configuration is very similar to what you would do for the style sheet profiling, in that you need to associate a compile options policy to the XML manager, and then in the compile options policy, setting up a matching debug rule. You can send a request to that service that has the style sheet, you know, maybe say via the curl command and pipe it to an HTML file. And when you open that HTML file in a web browser, you can see on the screenshot on the right how it walks you through the style sheet, for example, knowing what and when variables are getting set. And the little section on the bottom left, I know that's kind of hard to read. It's just a URL. It talks about a piece of work that a gentleman named Oliver Beckett did with a style sheet he created. In essence, it's a transformation style sheet which transforms any given XSLT style sheet into a version with additional trace functionality. I believe that might be it. If we can move to slide number 19, where Chin will take over. Chin, please.
Yes. Okay, thank you, Paul. My topic will be why do data per entry object fails when SSL connection after upgrade to V7 firmware. That is the topic that I'll be talking about, and then can you please go to the slide number 20? What we have done is that data per firmware version 6018 or later, 7.04 or later, or 7.102 or later, and 7.2 or later versions, we have disabled the SSL V3 protocol by default. We have given a tech note there. You can see that due to some security vulnerabilities, DataPower is not able to negotiate SSL V3 automatically or by default. So it will always negotiate with higher SSL protocols such as TLS 1.1 or TLS 1.2. So when your backend MQ server channel uses Cypher switch that supports only version SSL 3, and now you upgraded from, say, 5 or a lower 6 version to a 7 or 7.1 or 7.2, then those default settings will not allow to establish connection with SSL V3. So they will fail. So that is what I think you have to recognize, that because the default behavior is changed, you will need to change the configuration in DataPower so as to, you know, use either the TLS protocol, or if you are bound to use SSL V3, then you have to configure accordingly. Slide number 21, please. I have shown here, these are the ciphers which are compliant to TLS version 1.0 or 1.1 or 1.2 and its associated cipher and the cipher string and the options provided in Data Power. When you are configuring a SSL proxy profile, there are provisions, there are some configuration that you have to meet based on the MQ server channel cipher. You have to make sure that you use explicit cipher strings and the options are defined here. That will give you a guarantee that both Data Power and MQ server channel will negotiate to the same protocol with no connection failure. So that is what I think we are suggesting here, that in the security configuration, make it explicit so that you know what cipher string is being used compared to the backend server where the cipher is defined explicitly. So slide number 22, please. I have given you some example here that shows how you can select those configurations. So in this case, we have a crypto profile, the name called dp2-aix-crypto-profile. In that profile, if you open that, I can show you that here the cipher string says AES-256-SSA-256. So that particular string is defined because the backend is using TLS, you know, compatible TLS v1.2 cipher. And then you can see that how these boxes are checked. So, you know, enable default settings, which is, you know, standard. Then we will disable version SSL version 2, SSL version 3, and disable TLS version 1.1, and disable TLS version 1.1. Therefore, you are only allowing 1.2 with respect to this particular cipher, which is defined in the cipher string. And this has to match up to the MQ server channel SSL configuration, and therefore both should work without any problem if you make it, you know, configuration explicit. Go to slide number 23, please. I think that is probably, I just wanted to say, so my point here that, you know, we want to make sure that when you are making plan for upgrade, review these configurations, or if you upgraded, then make sure that you review these configurations to make sure that they are configured correctly with the correct setting, and therefore you will not have any problem. So with that, I will pass on to Brent for the SQL tracing.
Thank you, Chen. So we'll be going over how to effectively use SQL tracing on Data Power through the data source object. So before we go into enabling and mapping the trace file, I think it's important to go through when should tracing be looked at, when is it useful and when is it not. So in, I would say, most of the cases, a SQL category debug level logs will be sufficient for answering questions like, am I reaching the SQL data source object? Have I configured my XSLT correctly in trying to call a stored procedure? Right? Do I have input-output mapping that is matching what my DDL is on the database? So that is not what SQL tracing is for. SQL tracing is more along the lines of, did the driver side process fail unexpectedly? Did a toxic message cause it to reset? Was there an unexpected network event that maybe caused it to drop this transaction? So essentially the tracing will allow you to, if you will, read between the SQL category logs and see maybe a little bit more useful information what's happening at the driver level. So if we go on to slide 24, please. So first, to enable the SQL tracing, we can go into, you know, any SQL data source object and add a configuration parameter, that's trace file, and then we can specify a path. And here I've specified it to local. And once you start receiving connections, you'll start to see per connection a trace file named what you name it in the value start to populate in the directory that you've configured here. Slide 25, please. So it's important to note that one trace file is generated per connection. And now SQL connections based upon the configuration of idle connection timeout and the max connections available will definitely affect how many trace files are created and the size. So if you have many connections coming in, they may use the same trace file over and over again for different transactions. So a trace file can be put into the local, as I've shown in my previous slide, or you can put it into log temp. It would be useful to put it in log temp in cases where you expect to see many trace files coming in and you don't want to manually delete them. You can just do a reload of the firmware to remove these log temp files when you're done reviewing. Slide 26. So here's a section of an example here with the trace file. So this is what it would look like. It gives you some information. You'd be searching for things like SQL success, SQL error, and it will give you a little bit of information of what's occurring. Now, this by itself isn't entirely useful because you don't know the full context. Where it becomes useful is where you start to map this to the debug level logs, and I'll show that in the next slide. 27, please. So now you see when we enable the trace file is named my trace, which I've specified, and then it gives you a unique identifier at the end. This unique identifier is now logged in the debug level logs for SQL category. So you can see driver tracing enabled trace file is my trace file with the unique ID. And now once you enter this trace file, you'll also get another log message that you can map to the actual transaction, and that will say SQL executing on connection X, and that will bring you to the actual connection that is occurring. So with that and the timestamps that occur on both the SQL traces and the debug logs, you'll be able to map these two together. So it's currently supported in MS SQL and Oracle. You'll be able to enable this and run and map these files with debug-level logs. All right, slide 28, please. And with that, we can turn it over to Dominic.
Thanks, Brent. So we're going to go over the question of what would be a good memory setting for your virtual device, and this is specifically talking about physical memory. Can we please move to slide 29? So in the data power appliance, your resources are shared, your CPU, your memory. There is no way to allocate chunks of memory to a certain domain and say that's specifically for that domain. So your memory usage is going to highly depend on your configuration, you know, your custom domains that you define, your objects inside there, services, log targets, et cetera, as well as features you enable in the default domain, such as what Clarissa touched on earlier, like RBM. The second bullet point I want to touch on is that there are some main points that customers usually run into that they could avoid. First being that when you're on like an initial release 7.0.0.0, you don't have any fix packs. Typically, you'll find that later on there are a lot of memory-related fixes that come in those fix packs, and you typically want to be at the latest if possible. Obviously, there are situations that don't make it possible, but you definitely want to look out for that because that would be the first place you want to look. Second is obviously the device itself. You might be in development, you might be in production. Either case, you have transactions going through the box, you have people, you know, customizing their services, you know, you have pulling from remote, like things like IT cam, whatever you have, checking the device to make sure everything's working, health checks, etc. So those kind of things all use memory, and those are all going to be contributors here. Finally is default configuration settings in the appliance itself are not always the best. Unfortunately, some of these settings just don't work for customers, and it's typically advised that they are changed from the default setting. A great example of this is that in Data Power, your MQQ manager, retry attempts are set to zero, which actually means that we will always use our short interval, quote-unquote, which I believe is like 10 seconds or something like that, instead of reverting to our long interval for MQ connection attempts, which is, I believe, like 5 minutes. So that consistent polling, you know, can use a lot of memory because you're opening new connections frequently. Can we move to slide 30, please? So this is a rather general rule of thumb that I'm suggesting is that you have memory available to your virtual that's similar to your physical. Even if you're running virtual in both environments, maybe you allocate more to your production. I understand it's not a perfect world. You can't always have, say, you know, your production has 90 gigs. You might not want to allocate 90 gigs to your virtual. And the reason I touch on this is specifically because right now the requirements on the web might tell you, for example, on firmwares earlier than 7.0, that 4 gigabytes is okay. Yeah, maybe it's okay for basic development. Maybe you can go into the device and, you know, check things out and maybe modify some services, send a single transaction, do some basic testing. But depending on, you know, how complex your services are, how many domains you've thrown on the box, it might not work out as you want. And I actually generally recommend to all customers that come to me to at least have 8 gigabytes as a minimum, especially if you're on 7.0 or later, because there's just no way you're going to run 7.0 with 4 gigabytes correctly. So moving to the second and third bullet point, I'm just pointing out some simple examples. Unfortunately, I can't go through all the examples. Data Power being what we call black box, there's so much you can do with it. But these two examples, I think, are pretty dominant in customer configurations. The first being large service count. What do I mean by this? One example is, let's say you have a web service proxy in a domain, and you have 10 different WSDLs, and you all throw them into that same web service proxy. Now, the problem is, if you go in and you start changing that configuration, Data Power is going to have to actually recompile all those WSDLs. If you were to, say, have those in different web service proxies, you wouldn't be requiring so much recompilation and thus using so much memory to apply those changes. The same could be said for having multiple front-side handlers on the same multi-protocol gateway. Obviously, you can do the same in the web service proxy. So pretty much what I'm getting at is having a lot of referenced objects to each other, and when you apply changes, that's going to cause memory usage, and the more complex your service is, the more applied to it, it's going to cause higher memory usage, unfortunately. So a second example here is RBM mapping credentials, and obviously this was touched on earlier, and what I mean by this is when you have your mapping credentials, you can actually define down to an object level, do you want a user to read, write, execute objects. When you have a very complex credential mapping, that XML file, Data Power has to iterate through that entire list to determine, you know, the appropriate permissions, and when you're through things like WebGUI, it's going to cause a lot of churn and a lot of memory usage on that as well. So we do have some customers that, for example, have had to allocate 24 gigabytes to the virtual. The standard 8 gigabytes is not going to cut it when they have these very expansive credential mapping policies. So beyond just the examples I've given, I highly suggest reviewing John Rasmussen's Resource Management DeveloperWorks article. It's very handy. It's going to give you the basic understanding of everything, you know, what the basic memory statistic commands are, how you can narrow down at the domain level and the service level, and I think it might even link to the style sheet profiling that Paul touched on earlier. But that's the best all-in-one solution I suggest for trying to understand your memory usage as well as managing it. And with that, I'd like to 31 and pass off to Kathy, please.
Thank you for answering your pre-submitted questions. Now is the time that we need to move to the live Q&A session. I will reiterate one of the questions that was in the group chat, and I'll ask our panel to answer it. The question number 7 is, it comes from Neil. It says, we use multiple interfaces to prevent port conflicts with many services configured. Only two interfaces per zone, at four in total. Was this wrong? And yes, we manage our SW rules accordingly. Is there somebody on the panel that can answer that question?
Oh, sorry, I didn't know if you wanted me to re-answer that out loud.
Yes.
And if Neil is still on and wants to talk or open up the line, I'll be glad to real glad to talk about this. But the main way that I read that is that they have two interfaces per zone, two zones, so four total interfaces. And the main point was that if to prevent port conflict, when I read port conflict, I read that to mean multiple services listening on the same port, like port 80, port 443, 8080. If that's the case and we're just binding the multiple services to multiple IPs, then there's no need to have two interfaces, each with its own unique IP, and services bound to that. You can group IP addresses. You can have many secondary IP addresses on a single interface, and then allow IP, you know, 2 to listen on 80 and IP 3 to listen on 80 or 90 or whatever port you're using. So I guess the main way I can answer that question is it sounds as though Neil does have two interfaces per subnet. And I guess my main stress on that would be that check your routing table, and it sounds like you manage your firewall rules, which is great, but having two interfaces in the same subnet, if you've defined the IPs with the netmask and the gateway, then that's going to give you at least four dynamic routes generated, and that can lead to the non-deterministic routing that I spoke about earlier. And that's where I was really stressing, and I'll be honest, I made a mistake. I skipped slide 7. I spoke about it, but I didn't advance. The main thing I was going to stress on that was consider, to do fault tolerance, to group your IPs, to keep things simple, have a single link ag group, put multiple interfaces in it. You've got some link layer redundancy. Put your primary and your secondary IPs in there. But if Neil's talking about a different type of port conflicts, I would be glad to talk about those or answer any questions. Like I said, this is a very simple issue, but it's one that's actually been very busy, and I would not be stretching it to say that I'm fairly certain every one of the 30-something people that work in data power support has worked on this issue during their time here. At least once, if not many, many times.
Neil's reply was, thanks. I will need to research this more, as retrofitting isn't going to be easy.
Right. And the only thing I'll stress to Neil then is the routing table is kind of the core of this. That's what the multiple interfaces within the same subnet, that's really what it bleeds down into, is it creates a routing table that can become a nightmare. things predict in an unpredictable way. Sometimes folks will change network settings. And, Neil, if you want to talk more about this outside of this, or if you want to open a PMR and go over it, my name's Trey. Just feel free to ask for me. We'll have a quick phone call and go through the details.
In addition, Neil, on slide 3 of the presentation, we have the list of the panel of experts. Underneath Trey Williamson, there is a hot link to his email address. If you'd like to reach out to him that way as well, you can. I guess Trey, Neil knows you. He says he already knows you. He worked with you with the MQ Connection issue PMRs. So.
Okay. Hey, Neil.
I don't see anything else in there. So now we are going to go on to slide 33 and back to Paul for a summary of today's session.
Thank you, Kathy. Folks, just wanted to say thank you very much for coming today and listening to us. It was a pleasure in presenting this. And just to wrap things up, as you can see, you know, we touched a lot of different technologies, and Data Power does provide a deep breadth of integration and with various technologies. And the presentations today just touched upon a few of them, with style sheet profiling, MQ, the virtual appliance memory, and how they can be configured on Data Power and its benefits. So, again, pleasure in presenting to you, and you have our email addresses. And if there are any questions, you know, feel free to write. Thank you. Back to you, Kathy.
Well, thank you, Trey, Jin, Dominic, Brent, Clarissa, and Paul for presenting today. At this time, we would like to conclude the Ask the Expert session. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you, and we appreciate your participation. Thank you very much for joining us today, and a serious thank you to our panel of experts for presenting. You all have a great day.
Thank you.